I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Ken from Mission Viejo.
More water up here, and I know what to do with. There's a clock I can see. Thank you. Good evening. I'm Ken Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sober. But hell, I'm glad to be any place sober. I used to introduce myself when I spoke as glad to be sane, sober, and fully clothed. But the lady that I used to, when she was here, I told the story, and I haven't done that very often since she passed away. But tonight, if it goes good or bad, whichever, if I have too much time or not enough time, I may tell it anyway. But before you start, I'd like to, the Al-Anon lady that was here, or man, whoever raised their hand, I always like to mention Al-Anon when I get up here, because Al-Anon is very near and dear to my heart. If it wasn't for an Al-Anon or a lady in a drinking family, we wouldn't any of us be here, because when Bill Wilson left New York to go to Akron, Ohio, he talked to his wife and he said to Lois, what I'm doing, it hasn't worked. And she said, Bill, it's got to be working because you've been sober now longer than ever before. And if she would agree with him when he left to go to Akron, instead of walking the hall and stopping in the Akron Hotel and pick a telephone up, he could have walked to the end of the hall and went into the bar. I've been in that hotel. It's not a hotel anymore, but I went in and it's a nursing home or something, but I went in the place just to see it. So I'm very thankful for an Al-Anon, because the lady that I married and lived with for a lot of years and lived in sin for a few years and dated for a few years, I was living with her in sin, she went to Al-Anon for 2 years before, and I didn't even know she was going. I would come home at night, we'd have dinner, so I'd sit down in my chair, she'd sit down in hers, and I'd fill my glass of a whole half-quart can of beer, and I normally had it filled with vodka and a little tonic water. I'd sit there and drink that and watch TV. She'd get up and go to leave, and the first couple of times when she shared, she said she backed the car, she pushed the car out of the driveway before she started it so she didn't wake me up. And then she found out that she could have blown it up and not wake me up. So she'd go out, start the car, drove off, went to the Al-Anon meeting, come back, and would kiss me and say, let's go to bed, honey. And I think I had a wonderful night. So if it hadn't been for the Al-Anon lady, I probably would not have made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. For a couple of reasons. I was working at the office one afternoon with helping another man, and I had put one cheek on the filing cabinet and was leaning over and looking at some charts, and had been that way for quite a long time, and all of a sudden I had a funny pain in my chest. And so I just said to the young man that I've got to go home. I'm not feeling well, and I'll see you in the morning. And so I got in the car, and by the time I got halfway home, I'd been stretched up a little bit, and then it kind of went away. But as soon as I got home, I had a little taste of the dynamite that helped me stay alive. And when she came home, she came waltzing in the door and wanted to know what I was doing here so early, because I never got home early. And so I told her what happened, and she was working at the time for a surgeon who owned the Van Nuys Hospital. And she called him, and she took me to the Van Nuys Hospital, and there was two heart doctors and the surgeon there when I got there. And they went over me with a very fine tooth comb, and I had all kinds of tests, and I had wires every place you could find to put a wire. And they figured out that I hadn't had a heart attack or a stroke or any nonsense. So I got myself dressed, and as we're off walking out of the hall of the hospital, the one doctor said, I'd like to have you make an appointment and come and see me. And she, I guess he said, I'll call you to get the appointment. And I said to him as we went out the door, if you're going to tell me to quit drinking and quit smoking, I'm not coming. And he said, I'm not going to tell you that. So we went to see this doctor, and he did the best he could do to figure out if there was anything wrong with me. And he finally, after we were all through, about half three quarters of an hour, and Gussie was with me, the two of us never went to the doctor alone. We always went with each other. And the only doctor I didn't go in and visit with her was her gynecologist. But just before she passed away, he did ask me to come in and talk to him. So I did, and the psychiatrist, and they both asked me to come in, and I did get to go in and talk to them. But anyway, I went to see him, and when we got through and we walked, was getting ready to walk out, he said, Ken, if you keep doing what you're doing, you won't live 18 months. And I said, thank you very much, and I left. Well, I outlived him. I outlived his estimate, but not by too far anyway. He and I had lived together quite a little while, and a few days after the 18th month, it dawned on me after I looked at my calendar, she told me that she didn't, she asked me if I wouldn't, I had an apartment all the time when I was doing this. I had an apartment that I kept paying rent on. She told me, you better move back to your apartment because I don't want to watch you kill yourself. So we had dinner Friday night in a Japanese restaurant. I remember that, but I'm not sure where it was located when she told me this. And I have no idea how long I was gone. Whether it was 2 days or a week or a month or whatever, I have no idea, to be honest with you. And she never did tell me. I come to on Sunday morning, and I got up and my jacket, the sport jacket, was laying on the couch, and so I picked it up and was going to hang it up, and both pockets were kind of bulging out a little bit, and I reached in the pockets and I had about, I don't know, anywhere from six to a dozen little matchbooks about that long and about that wide, little boxes of stick matches, and on the box it said Marrakesh Restaurant, and the Marrakesh Restaurant is on Newport Beach. I lived in downtown Los Angeles, and I apparently sometime over the weekend I was at the Marrakesh. And Marrakesh is a restaurant where you sit on couches, or you sit on the floor on pillows, and you feed your partner and all this stuff. And I have no idea who my partner was or whether I had one. But all the guys that I sponsor, I tell them that there's only two things in the world that I won't admit to having done. And you can ask me anything you want to, and I'll tell you. But there's two things that I won't admit to. And the first one is that I won't admit to ever having murdered anyone. And the second one is that I never intentionally slept with a man. However, when you don't know where you've been or how long you were there or when you got back, anything could have happened. And I had that happen. I had that happen to me a lot of times. I don't relate to a very small portion of the big book. And it says, trip or no trip. And I never not took a trip. When the notion struck me, I went. It didn't make any difference where it was or how long it was or whether I was on vacation or whether I was supposed to be going to work in the morning or whatever. I just left and went. And a lot of times I drove, and I kept in the trunk of my car on one side a sleeping bag, fishing tackle box, pair of tennis shoes, Levi's shirt. On the other side I had a suit, white shirt and a tie, pair of slippers, a pair of loafers, socks and a tie and a tie tack, and this I could go to work, and this I could go play. And I always kept a little something for the intestinal fortitude so I can manage to get up and move. And I would get tired or think I was going to pass out or whatever. And I've slept in every parking lot of a restaurant between San Clemente and Northridge on the ground beside my car in a sleeping bag at least once. Because if I thought I was having trouble seeing the two lines or getting the two lines to get together, I would close one eye, and if that didn't help, I would go off the freeway at the next place I could see some place to stop. And if I was about halfway between here and Phoenix in those days, I'd just pull the car beside the road, get out, go around on the passenger side, unroll the street, bang, go sleep. Today you do that, the car would be gone and you'd be laying there sleeping. You know, so. But in those days, people didn't do things like that. I mean, I don't know whether anybody drove by or not or anything, but I always pulled it off of the road. I did have sense enough to do that instead of leaving it set in the middle of the road and get up and go to sleep. But I have raised my head real quick and see the light was green, and don't know whether it was the first time it changed green or third or fifth time, but I would then go through. But I never drove without drinking. And in the days towards the end of my drinking, they came out with this material, double knit, they called it a double knit material, I had double knit shirts and double knit suits and double knit ties and double knit anything. That was the most wonderful piece of material that any man invented. Because you could get up in the morning and stand in the shower and then go out and stand in the parking lot in the sun for a few minutes and you'd look like you came straight out of Brooks Brothers. Absolutely perfect. I mean, that was the most beautiful material that man ever made. And I used to make comments about, I always had on a nice pair of slacks and I always had on a nice suit or whatever. And I made a comment to that one night before Gussie was going to share, and there's a bunch of people standing around, and she got up and shared, and she made the comment that during the break I was talking about the wonderful clothes that I used to wear, and she said it was like looking at cheesecloth. Had all those little bitty holes in them. Because I drove and smoked and drank, and I put the big glass between my legs or whatever, light that cigarette and smoking, and she would say, sweetheart, would you roll up the window? And I'd put the button and up it'd go, and then I'd put the cigarette out, and then those ashes are in the cockpit. We're on the freeway at about 80 miles an hour. That drink is between my legs, and I've got all these little things dropping on me, and every time those little ashes hit you, they just burnt the material just a little bit. And that's what I was wearing when I got here. And for a long time, I told everybody that I always had on nice clothes, and to me, they were. But she corrected me, and so I quit referring to that other than in a meeting like this, that's the kind of clothes that I was wearing. And I was working for a very large corporation. I did 35 years with them, and God only knows how I did, because if it hadn't been for God, I would not have made it, I'll guarantee you. I worked for this company, and I was wearing some of those suits into my drinking, and thought I was perfectly dressed and appropriate. And I called on some of the largest companies in the Los Angeles and Orange County, and I've met the chairman of the board of many, many companies, and the president, and a lot of vice presidents, and that's the kind of clothes I wore. I also, when I got here, I got here October the 28th, 1978, and I had a 78 Mercury Marquis. And I bought it in the late 77. So it was about a year old, but it was a nice car. And I always thought it was anyway. Yeah, but the one tail, the one fender hung down a little bit and the tail light was out. So I put red cellophane over it because it broke the glass. I pulled into a filling station that I always bought gas at. That was on Vermont, and I lived on off of Beverly and Vermont on Commonwealth. And I always got gas in here, and you had to pull out up and go up the hill, and I didn't quite make the hill, so I backed up and knocked over the young man's pump, and he come flying out of there. No gas was coming out, so he said, go ahead and go. And I thought, I'll tell the boss I don't know who did it. And so I just drove off, and I was going down to Vermont, headed for something like that. I think it was a Dutch oven. Anyway, it was just before noon. I had stayed in the office as long as I could handle it. And there used to be a Budget rent-a-car right there. And a lady just pulled out of the parking lot at Budget in a brand new Cadillac and drove into the front quarter panel on my car. And she kept screaming at me, and she wanted me to call the police and all kinds of stuff. And I said, just take all this information, and I wrote it down for her, gave it to her. Take that in, give it to Budget. Tell them what you did. And you had to be the one moving because I can't hit you sideways, so you had to drive into me. And so she did, and I never heard anything from anybody. I didn't hear from my insurance company. I took it down to the insurance company. I told the insurance company what happened, and they said, go get it fixed, and everything was fine. I was driving down that same boulevard one night, and the rain, it was pouring down rain, and I bumped the man in front of me, and he had just picked up a brand new BMW. And I didn't think I bumped him hard enough to make any mark on him whatsoever, but I got out in the rain, and he got out in the rain, and I couldn't see that I hit him, but he found a little scratch on his bumper. So I gave him all the information, and they went back to get in my car, and I swear to God that I'd lock the keys in the car, the engine's running, and I can't get in the damn door. So the man come back to see what was wrong, and I told him, and he just reached in and opened the door from inside. The window was down, and I didn't even know it. And that was a long, long ways from the time I finally got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could talk about those kinds of things for a lifetime that I did that were even funny at the time. Because when I on that same street, I always went that street to get to the freeway. Just before you get to the freeway, there's a liquor store across the street and a telephone booth. We had telephone booths then, we didn't have cell phones. And I'd pull up and park, and I'd go across the street and get me a six-pack of beer and come back across and get the car and drive off. Well, I did that. And there was a bunch of little ruddy kids running around out there having fun, and I got back to the car, and no keys. So I whack over to the liquor store and ask the guy at the liquor store, did I leave my keys in here? And he started looking, and we couldn't find my keys. So I went back I looked across the street and everything else. I went back and told us, I offered those kids $10 if they could find my keys. They couldn't find my keys. I couldn't find my keys, and so I went in the telephone booth and called the lady that I was going to go out to see to bring me an extra set of keys and come and get me. And I'm essentially at the on-ramp. So she did. She brought me the keys, and I got in the car and drove, and she followed me, and I drove out of the valley. I met her. I had taught a class at one of IBM. I was with IBM. I taught a class at one of IBM's offices. And some years earlier, a man worked for me, and he was working in Dallas, Texas. And I don't know how he found out, but he found out that I was teaching this class, and he convinced his boss that he just had to have the information I was about to depart. And so on Friday, he said to me, "Are you going home?" And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "Well, I'm just staying in a hotel across the street. I'll buy you dinner." I said, "Okay." So we went over and bought dinner, sitting there having drinks, and I didn't know it. Apparently he did, but I didn't know it. All of a sudden, this big long mall started to roll back. Way down at the end is a stage with a complete band on it and people all over the place. And so we sat there and had a couple more drinks and finished our conversation. Pretty soon, he said, "See those two ladies at that table over there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Let's go dance with them." And I said, "No, no. Five of them just come in and sit down at that table over there, and I'm going to dance with all five of them." So he went over and asked one of those little ladies to dance, and I went over and had to squeeze by, and I walked three on one side, two on the other. I walked past two of them to the third one, and I asked her to dance. She did. And as I was leaving, the lady that was sitting next to her had her head down like she was unhappy or bored or whatever. Anyway, I just leaned down and said to her, "Smile, it's going to get better." And as I started to walk across the dance floor, the song by Kris Kristofferson came on and said, "Was Help Me Make It Through the Night." And I flew back over there and said, "Would you dance with me?" And we danced together for about 40 years. And she was in a wheelchair. And we flew into New Orleans, and our son that lived in Norway picked us up, and we were going to Florida because he had bought a condo and we was going to go look at it. We wasn't going to stay in, but we were going to look at it. And we had rented a house. He had rented a house on the beach. And so we went over and looked at his house and then went to the beach. Spent 4 days at the beach. And he was driving us back to New Orleans. And on the way, he said, "Is anybody hungry?" And I said, "I could eat something." So he stopped, got off the freeway. I think we're in Alabama. But he got off the freeway and he went in this nice little restaurant. And there was a piano and a stool. And pretty soon the guy came out in his guitar and put one cheek on that stool and started to play his guitar. And so we sat there and listened for a little bit. And John is 21 and in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Lives in Norway, has for 34 years now. We both ordered a cup of coffee, and this guy started to play, and then he played two or three songs, and then he started to play that Kris Kristofferson song again. And Gussie said, "Would you dance with me?" And I said, "Do you think you can?" She said, "Let's try." So I got her out of the wheelchair, and I had to put one foot on mine because she couldn't move that one foot very well. And we danced the same song, "Help Me Make It Through the Night." That was the last time that we danced. The first time we danced, I asked her. The last time we danced, she asked me. And I had that played at her services. And some of the people thought I was nuts, but then the Al-Anons took over, and when I was the first one they called to speak, I explained to them why I had that song played. And if you call me on my cell phone, you hear that song. So I still, she's close to me all the time. I keep her close to me, and I miss the hell out of her, but she died in August 28th, 07, at 11:28 in the morning. I was holding her. She opened her eyes, and I said, "My God, what beautiful eyes." Leaned down to kiss her. She took one breath and passed away. And couldn't have happened in a better way. I had not gone to AA meetings for 4 years because I never left her out of my sight. I went to leave one night, and she said, "Come here a minute." So I walked over. She whispered in my ear because a girlfriend of hers was going to stay with her. She said, "You know, when you leave, my whole world goes with you." And I never left her again. That was about 3 years, I guess. She was in a wheelchair for four, but about 3 years when I quit going to meetings. When she went to the hospital, I checked in. When she went to physical therapy, I checked in. No matter where she went, I checked in with her, and all the doctors got to know that was going to happen, and so they just automatically put her in a single room and either had a recliner or a rollaway put in so I could stay with her. And so that's one of the reasons I think Al-Anon is something else, because that lady did so much for Al-Anon women. It was unbelievable. And she did so much for me. And if it hadn't been for her the morning that I made that telephone call, I wouldn't have got here. I called her that Sunday morning, and I tried to open two cans of beer, or a can of beer and a little can of tomato juice. I had two of them. I already set out two cans of beer, two cans of tomato juice on the counter, and a glass that would hold a pair of them. And I tried to open those two beers, or that open with beer and tomato juice, and I couldn't get the beer open. And I tried everything I could think of to do. I didn't get a fork or anything, but I should have. Last time I used a fork, the reason I didn't do that, because the last time I used a fork, I popped it, and the lid thing come off. So I put the fork on that, pulled it up a paper plate in about four layers, and put it on top, and bammed it like that, and I still have the paper part of the paper plate in my hand down here. Every once in a while, it kind of festers up a little bit, and I can squeeze it, and it's like it's still got the hole there. So I remembered that, and so I didn't try anything nonsense like that morning. And I don't know why I did, but I couldn't get them open, so I called her, and I talked to her. And I really don't know what the conversation was, but I apparently, she said she asked me if I drank, she thought I drank too much, or I thought I drank too much, and she told me that I said yes. Well, I suppose I must have. And so she gave me a telephone number of a man, and I called him. And don't know why I did that. I never took orders from anybody. My dad said to me when I was 15 years old, if you're going to live in my house, you got to live by my rules. And I left. And I went back, and I never did move back in the house, but I went back and finished half of the senior year, the rest of the junior year and half the senior year, got him to sign my papers and joined the Navy when I was 17 years old. And I'll tell you about that. But anyway, I called this guy that morning, and we talked, and I don't know what the hell we talked about, but we talked, and he said to me, This is about all the conversation I remember. He said, "I don't make 12-step calls anymore, so I can't come and pick you up." Well, I didn't know what the hell a 12-step call was, and I didn't want him coming and picking me up. I didn't want anybody coming to pick me up. He said, "Why don't you call the lady that gave you the number back?" And so I did. I called her back, and she said, have you had anything to drink yet today?" And I said, "No." She said, "Then if you can come out here, I'll take you to a meeting." I didn't know what the hell meeting we're going to, but I was going out there. So I drove out to the San Fernando Valley, and we went to the hole in the sky. It's a room over a filling station, and I think it's in Sherman Oaks. I never went back. That's the only time I was ever in it. And I had no idea what the room looked like until I went to Southern California Convention about 3 years ago, and a lady was speaking, and she said the first meeting she ever went to was the Hole in the Sky, and she explained what the room looked like. So I knew what the room looked like. It may have been a little more disrepair than it was when I got there, but she was about 4 or 5 years behind me, so it couldn't have been too much more disrepair, and she explained it quite well. Anyway, we went to that meeting in the morning, and the only thing I remember about that meeting is one man. I don't know whether it was a speaker's meeting or a discussion meeting or what it was, but I remember the one man shared, and he said he bought his first watch and he bought his first wallet. And I said to myself, I have a watch and I have a wallet and it's got money in it, and I got a car sitting out there that's a year old, so I can't be like him. The other thing I remember, that there was a man in there with a white Stetson cowboy hat on. And until he passed away, I used to go to the San Fernando Valley every once in a while, and always around April 15th, because my tax man was out there. And we would go out there and stay 2 or 3 days and try to be there so we could go to a Thursday and Friday meeting. She went to an Al-Anon meeting on Thursday, and I'd go to a Benny AA meeting, but I went to a Friday night AA meeting. And the man in the white Stetson cowboy hat was never, I mean, he was always there. I never went to that meeting, no matter when it was, that he wasn't there, until he passed away. And he and I spent a lot of hours together. He was the general manager of the Bartenders Union. So I guess you can be around liquor and stay sober, because he was there when I got there, and he lived a long time afterwards. So anyway, we went to that meeting, and that's all I remember about it. We drove around the rest of the day. I don't know if we ate or did anything, but all I remember is we drove around, and we went to a meeting on Ventura Boulevard. It was a church. The only thing I remember about that meeting was we're walking up a long walk, wide walk, so we're walking side by side, and a man come walking towards us. He walked right straight up to me, stuck his hand out. I shook hands with him. He said, "Come on, let's go get a cup of coffee. I think you need it." Why he picked me instead of her, I don't know, but he saw that from a distance. The only thing I remember about the man is he said he worked for Chevrolet. And I don't really know why I remember that. I had one Chevrolet, didn't like it. And I don't care. I have a Chevrolet with a fancy logo, an emblem on it. It's still the General Motors car, but I was never crazy about Chevrolet. Why I remembered that, I don't know. But she did let me stay with her Sunday night. And Monday morning when I got ready to go to work, she said, "I would suggest to you that you go to a meeting every day if you want to come back Friday." And I said, okay. And I wasn't going to, but about 2:30 on Monday, I got the shaking so bad that I had to get up and leave. And I left and I drove to a telephone booth and I asked the operator to give me central office. Central office in Los Angeles was about 3.5 blocks from my office. And he gave me the name of a place called the Pathfinder, which was on 5th and Western. I was about 3 blocks from Western and 5 blocks from the place, so I was about 8 blocks from Pathfinder. And I was there every day, sometimes earlier than 2, sometimes later. But I went there when I could not stand it anymore. The shaking got so bad I couldn't stand it. And I would go down there and sit down there. And they had a crock pot, old brown crock pot. And the first day I went in there, they had 3 weenies in there that looked pretty good, so I had one. And a couple days later, I had another one, and then there was this last little thing in there, and I didn't like the looks of it. It was kind of getting grayer and grayer every day. And he wouldn't put new ones in there until I was gone. And I guess I was bad enough off one day that I bought that thing and ate it, and he filled that thing back with brand new weenies, and everybody in the room, I mean everybody in the Pathfinder that night knew who I was. Because that guy told him that I was the one that ate that weenie that nobody would eat so they could get fresh ones. And he was about this tall, and his name was Rule. And I went to that Pathfinder every day for a long time. And I never said I was an alcoholic. In those days, if you're a newcomer, you just did this. And I did that most of the time, until I thought I had done that long enough. And one night he was leading the meeting, and he called me to come up, and I said, "I pass." And he called on somebody else, a couple people, and he said, "Ken?" And I said, "I pass." And he called on somebody. He come walking down the aisle and sat down beside me on a bench. In the back of there was a bench in the meeting. And I was sitting on that bench. He sat down beside me. When the guy was through, he took me by the hand and said, "Come on." And he led me up there and he said, "Tell those people who you are and why you're here." So I said, "I'm Ken and I don't know why I'm here." And walked off. And sometime later, after I finally decided that I was an alcoholic, he took me down to Clancy's little recovery house in the slums in Los Angeles, the Midnight Mission. And on the way down there, before I agreed to go, he said, "All I'm going to do is just ask you to read something." And I said, "Okay." So on the way down there, he said, "There's a couple from Long Beach is coming, and they're going to share. So I'll lead the meeting, and then I'll ask you to read something, and then they'll share, and then I'll read the Serenity Prayer." And we pass the basket, and there's, it's a coffee can, and you can, in the old mission, if you were there, they had like the pews in the church, the old wood pews, that's what they had in that old mission. And you carried the coffee can, and those guys would dig in their pockets and get out, change, and drop it in that can. We cut cigarettes in half and cut donuts in half and unwrap the cigarettes and put them in baskets, and they could each take one. And a couple from Long Beach didn't show up for some reason. And so he read, and then I read, and then he shared a little bit, and then he called me up, and I was supposed to share a little bit, and I have no idea what I said or how long I was there, but I did stand up there for a little while. And then he shared again, and then I read, and he closed the meeting. He took me back up there about 4 or 5 times while I was going to the Pathfinder. And I was sober about 3 or 4 months, and I'm still shaking. I mean, I really had the jitters. But every Friday night, we'd go to that speaker's meeting in the San Fernando Valley. The first night I was there, a man came up to me, and he said, "Boy, you're in trouble, and you need help, and I'm it." And he put his arm under mine and walked me away. And I don't know why I let him do that, because I didn't let anybody do that. I did time in the Navy for 4 years. I went as a seaman, got out as a seaman. That's tough to do. I got an honorable discharge. I passed a test for yeoman and personnelman and didn't get rated either time. The first time I was in the break, second time they didn't have an opening. And I had 9 captain's masses and no court martial. But I had 9 captain's masses and still got out with an honorable discharge. Part of the reason why I was a captain yeoman for 2.5 years on the Rochester. And that saved a lot of ground. And the last half year I was on there, I was the commander that was in charge of the intelligence office on the Bonham Richard that I was on first. He came on as the navigator on the Rochester, saw me and asked me if I'd come and be his secretary. And I said, "Talk to the captain." And so he went over and talked to him and came back and said, "Sure." So I was his yeoman for the next 6 months. And I had to run of everything, because the only thing he really required, we had some reports we had to fill out when we were in port, but the only thing he required, even when we were on the Bonham Richard, was we had to do the reports and have coffee at 7 in the morning. He'd come walking to that office at 7 o'clock sharp every morning, and if there was coffee there, and when we were in port, he didn't care who made the coffee, and he didn't care whether you were aboard ship or gone, as long as there was coffee in the morning and you were aboard ship when we left. And so you kind of had, if you have that kind of a job and the officers treat you like they do, you got away with a lot. And I don't know why, but they took pity on me. But when I got here, I'll give you an idea of just how really well I was. I had alcohol poisoning sores all the way to my knees. I was afraid to take my socks off in the evening, but if I'd sweat that day, for fear I'd peel the skin off of the bottom of my feet. And I shook. And why IBM kept me employed, I don't know, but they did. And I was a manager for 17 years and still manage it. And then I made a call. I was put on a special assignment twice, and one of them was I made a call with another manager from another office, and when we came back from making that call, he asked me if I wouldn't be in the marketing. And I said, "Sure, why not?" About a week later, my manager said, "That marketing manager that made that call with wants to talk to you, and I'm going on vacation tomorrow, so whatever you two decide on is okay with me." So I went over and talked to him, and he said, "Would you like to be in marketing?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Well, you are." And that was about the 6th of July, the 15th, no, the 6th of June, the 15th of June, I took a territory. And at the end, and December 31st, I had made 100% quota. I'd made it before then because I went to a 10-week class and wasn't in the territory then. And I'd already made my first quota selling, and I'd never sold anything in my life before. Yeah, no, almost not anything. Sold refrigerators and televisions for another guy once on weekends, but that's all. And I had no IBM marketing training, but I managed to be quite successful at it. So how I got through, I don't know. They never served a drink of alcohol for any reason to anyone. No matter what, the vice president of IBM World Trade was the son of the founder of the IBM Corporation. he made an incident on a first class flight on an airplane coming from Europe, because he was in charge of Europe, World Trade. And his brother was the chairman of the board at the time, found out that he had been drinking, and he removed him from his position. And until he retired, he floated around headquarters with no job assignment, because he was made the incident while he was drinking, and his brother removed him from assignment. Why I managed to get through, I don't know, but I did. Anyway, the first night that we went to that meeting, and this man grabbed me by the arm and said, "Do you need help?" And I'm it. The lady that night said, "If you don't have a big book, steal it. If you can't afford a big book tonight, steal it. You can make amends later." And Ron sat in the front seat. His wife used to sit by him. And I sat, the first night I sat over, and then my wife sat next, or my lady sat next to me. After that, he had me sit beside him, the two women sat on the end. But that night, we got ready to get up and leave, he said, "Go buy a big book. I know you got money enough to do it." So I went and got it. He said, "Come on, there's light out in the parking lot behind the church. We're going back there." So we went back behind the church, and he said, "Open the book to the far left-hand page." So I opened it to the far left-hand page, and he said, "What do you see?" And I said, "I see nothing." And he said, "Good. That's what you know." He said, if you keep that in mind, that's all you know, and do what the book tells you to do, and do what I tell you to do, you'll have a chance." And I said, "How often do I have to go to these meetings?" And he said, "How often did you drink?" And I said, "I drank daily." He said, "It might be a good idea then to go to meetings daily." And I used some profanity, but basically what I said is, "How long do I have to go to these meetings?" And he said, "Go to the meetings until you want to go to the meetings, and go to the meetings." And I'm sure that sometime during the first 120 days that I was going in and out of the meetings, somebody must have said along the line, "Go to 90 meetings, 90 days, or we'll refund your misery," or whatever, you know, the people say. I don't recall ever having heard that. Because at the end of 90 days, I left, because I was not in good shape yet at all. And this lady after that meeting on Friday night, we're sitting in the booth, and she sat next to me, and I still clattered when I picked my cup up off that saucer, and she said, "My God." She said, "You got the whips and jangles, boy. You better have some sweets." And I proceeded to tell her all about how I made donuts when I was going to high school, and I hadn't had a sweet since. And the next week, I went back, and I had the same shake, and she said, "Ken, you better have some sweets to eat." And so I ordered a piece of peach pie and ice cream. And I ate that piece of peach pie and ice cream, and almost instantly, the shakes went away. And if you saw me walk up here, you know that I have not quit eating peach pie and ice cream yet. And until I cannot do it, I intend to continue to eat peach pie and ice cream. But almost instantly, I quit with the shakes, and I said to myself, "Just maybe if I do what these people tell me to do, maybe I'll get better." And so Ron said to me, "We're going to do the steps out of the big book. You can buy the 12 and 12 if you want. That doesn't tell you how to work them. It explains about them, which might help you. Since you're dumb enough, I suggest you go ahead and spend the money, because I know you can afford it." So I didn't open the 12 and 12 for, I don't know, quite a few years. And I sense I've read everything that has been printed. Just about, I haven't got the new one you've got laying over there yet. But I have a bookcase full of just about everything that has been printed. I have a first, second, and third edition. I'm not the fourth yet, but it's the first, second, and third edition of the big book. My wife bought that first edition big book for me on my 15th birthday. She had this ring made for me on my 10th birthday. She took good care of me, and you keep giving those little incentives for me to stay sober, I think. But so we started to do the steps, and as they're written in the big book. And I said to him, "When do we get together?" And he said, "Well, when you can read far enough to know where the words 'being convinced' are in the big book, then we'll get together and talk about the big book. But until you can read that far, you just keep reading until you can show me where those words are. And then we'll talk about whether you're convinced or not." And I said to him, one day I said, "Ron, I can't sleep very good. I don't get to sleep at night." He said, "Read the big book. It's good therapy. It'll put you to sleep." So I started reading it. I'd go lay down and read it, and I'd read, and I'd put a marker in the page that I had finished on. couldn't tell where I'd finished, whether it was the top of the page, the bottom of the page, over here, down here, whatever. So I'd go turn back to the next, back and read it, and then turn back until I finally found I had read this, and so I'd start reading again. And I think I read every page in the first, through all those X's and I's and all that stuff. I read that until, and the doctor's opinion so many times, it was unbelievable until I could go to, and look where I knew where I was. I started turning the corner down on the line that I finished on. And started there, and I'd start above that, the paragraph above, I still couldn't remember it. So I started until I read them, and I read them over and over and over again. And then they made a mistake and put them on tapes. And I listened to tapes. I when I became a marketing rep, I drove and drove and drove and drove, and I played nothing but AA tapes and Big Book and stuff. And I can tell you, if somebody say something that's in the book or not in the book, and I pretty well tell you whether it is or not, but I can't tell you where to find it. And I used to say something about it, and then I'd have to go stick the tapes in until I could figure out what tape it was on. Then I could look it up in the book and know what chapter it's in. So I haven't played that now for quite a while either, but... And I don't try to quote the book in chapter and verse, but I do. Every once in a while, I'll quote them things that it says. And one of the things that I like in the Big Book, it says we go home and take the book down off the shelf and review the first five proposals. So this is paraphrasing. It's not what it says. For which we're building it and put the foundations in place because we're building an archway to water that we'll walk through as a free man. And when I got to that and read that and understood it, I really felt more like I was free instead of just loose. I used to get out of jail and say, God, I'm free. And I said that one night to Ron when I was talking about, I did 9 weekends in jail once. And I said every Sunday morning when I got out, I'd say, my God, I'm free again. And he said, no, Lisa, you're just, Lisa, he called me when he liked me. And when he didn't, he had other things to call me. But he said, Lisa, you're not free, you're just loose. And I did that for a lot of times. I did 9 weekends in jail. I would drive my car into the parking lot in downtown Los Angeles on 5th and Temple, or Temple and Hill, excuse me. Park on one side of the temple and walk under the temple and get to the police officer and check in, get on a steel elevator and go up to the 5th floor. They give you a key, you unlock the locker, you put all your clothes in, give them back the key, you put it on a tag and your name, you walk through the door, strip naked, they'd spray you, dip you, search you, do all the stuff they did. You went through another door, they hand you some clothes, you put them on, and you went in and got in a bunk. I would pull my car into the parking lot over there, and I'd take a fifth of vodka out, and I'd drink all I could drink. And then I would walk as fast as I could walk across the street, so I didn't look too obvious when he saw me coming. And I'd just keep saying, don't stop me someplace. And I would get in, and it didn't take me long to go to sleep when I got in the bunk. And when I got up, I would go back across the street and drink what was left in that bottle, drive down to the apartment on Commonwealth, take a shower. While I was there, I'd drink a half-quart beer, take the other five with me, and between downtown Los Angeles and Encino on Nordoff in the San Fernando Valley, I drank the other five beers. And when I got to about the time to do my steps, I had no problem knowing that I was absolutely and totally crazy. Because nobody would do anything like that. I took a motorhome trip with five kids in the car. The youngest one was 3 years old. I got a 502 that night. I told one story for a long time. My oldest son said, can I come to the meeting tonight? And because I was speaking, and I said, sure. On the way home, he said, you lied to people. And I said, what? And he said, yes, you lied to them. And I said, what did I do? And he said, you told them we went back up on the mountain in Beaver, Utah, after we got ice cream. And we didn't. He said, but since I was old enough to drive, he said, you can drive, and we went to Fillmore, Utah. But he said, as soon as we got out of town far enough that you thought he wouldn't know that I was driving, you drove to Fillmore, Utah. I got up the next morning, drove back to Beaver, pleaded not guilty, and posted bail, and drove back to Fillmore, Utah, picked up those five kids, and we left. And I didn't know that I'd made the round trip three times. And so I had no trouble realizing that I was completely crazy. I've had so much fun in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. I've had so many good things happen to me that it's absolutely unbelievable. I 13 years after I quit drinking, I retired. I was 50. I was going to retire at 55, and I didn't quite make it. I turned 56 in February. I actually retired in April because a friend of mine was in New York that I'd hired in January 1960 in Beverly Hills. He was a personnel. He was in personnel at headquarters. Told me that IBM was going to change their program to extend myself, and I did. And so I got much more money as a result of that. And in 13 years, I had made enough money to retire with 35 years. So just imagine how much I had spent before. Because I even had a man walk up to us beside me one day, and he said, "Oh, you can't lease?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I'd like my Union Oil credit card." And I said, "Okay." We gave it to him. In those days, if you didn't pay over $25, they just didn't look you up on their listing. If you spent more than $25, they'd look you up on that list. I never spent more than $25 on that card. I'd buy $10, $15 worth of gas, and they never checked it until I had so much money on it that they thought they'd come and get it. I've had some very, very bad things happen to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had to drink. I never had to drink when I got on a cruise ship going to on a 9-week trip on the Crystal Harmony, my first trip I'd ever made, a brand new ship. It came from Japan with this crew, and we were the first passengers on board that ship. We went 9 weeks to Australia and back. We had 27 ports in the South Pacific. We were in New Zealand, Tahiti, Australia. Wonderful. Right, and I walked in the room, and there's free champagne bottles sitting on the table in the room, I didn't have to drink, and I've had some very tough things happen to me. First and foremost, my wife passed away, and I didn't have to drink over it. I wanted to, but I didn't have to. I've had cancer three times. I had a piece on a little bit on my leg. I thought they had cancer in a tumor I had in my nose. I had thyroid cancer and prostate cancer, and I didn't have to drink through any of those. I was sitting on a Wednesday. I'm about to run out of time. I was sitting in a Wednesday night meeting, which is my home group, the Mission Viejo Missionaries. We meet on Wednesday night. I used to be on Oso and Marguerite, now I was on Felipe and Marguerite. But we were on the Oso meeting, and my wife knocked on the glass window, and I opened the door and went out. And I didn't come back. And the guys, I sponsored a lot of guys then. I still sponsor a few, but not that many. I sponsored a lot of guys in that meeting that night, and I had a rule that we never left the meeting without holding hands. And I didn't come back, so they knew something was wrong. So by the time I got home, and my wife had come out, somebody had come to the house to the meeting and got her, because my wife was in the aisle of my meeting, four or five doors down in that church. And when we got home, our house was filled with people from Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. So if you're in the program and you're not on the edge, if you get to the meetings early and you have some kind of a responsibility to do, you do set up chairs. Or I used to point the church chairman, still do at this meeting, chairs and coffee and literature and secretary and intergroup rep and general service rep. And you do all those things just for one meeting, and you get all those things done. You're about 7 or 8 years sober. So if you just have a responsibility, that's if they'll let you have them continuously in the meeting. A lot of meetings don't let you have them, just keep rolling on something else. So if you have a responsibility all the time, I don't know how you can drink. I don't know how a person can do the things that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells them. Have a sponsor, work with other people, be involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and do things. Do things for somebody, some people, somebody that they don't know that you've done them, and you don't have to broadcast it to let them know. If you do those other kind of things, I just don't know how you can possibly drink. The night that my wife picked me up at that meeting, on the way home, she told me my son had hung himself. And I wanted to drink bad. I needed to drink bad. But she drove me home, and we walked in the door, and half of Orange County Al-Anon and AA was already there. So you don't have to go through anything in your life alone if you don't want to. And I'll give you a little challenge tonight. I gave you my telephone number. I put my cell phone on a charger, and I lay it on the side of the bed with me, and I answer it anytime it rings. And if you're sober, I'll talk to you. And if you're drunk, I'll tell you you can go to hell by yourself. But if you're sober, I'll talk to you. I had a lady that used to live here. She was in Virginia, and she didn't realize what the time was, and she called me at 3:00 in the morning. And I talked to her for about an hour and a half before I finally said to her, "Do you realize that I'm in California and you're in Virginia and the time difference?" And she said, "Oh, my God." And I said, "Well, I told you a long time, and I sponsored her husband. And I told her husband that he could call me anytime he wanted to, because my phone is on my bed at night." And I finally agreed to get a cell phone. So you call me, and if you can convince me that it's bad enough, I'll go with you. And if you convince me that it's good enough, I'll go with you. I have enough money right here to take us to Vegas and blow our brains out. And I have a little additional supply that I keep with me in other places. I'm not on my body, but I keep with me. So I'm never without a chance if I have to have it. But if it gets good enough or bad enough and you can convince me, I'll go with you. But it says in the big book, one person talking to another. And if we do that, I believe that you can talk yourself into not doing it if you talk to me. No matter how bad it is or how good it is, by the time you get through talking to me, you'll talk yourself into not having to. So get my number and call me. Thank you very much for letting me share. It's 9:30 on the spot. I'm a little late.